Robin Hood Radio presents Agriculture from Tucana Farms. Here's Mark Scherzer.
Bupkis, it rhymes roughly with upkiss, is the dismissive term my late mother Sylvia always used to describe something that is so paltry as to be meaningless. You spent all that time studying anthropology, and what have you got to show for it? Bupkis. You want to be a farmer? What? And work for Bupkis? Like so many evocative Yiddish words that have been absorbed into English, Spilkis, Schmuck, Tuchus, with their hard consonants softened and comicalized by sibilance, Bupkis has the perfect sound to represent its meaning, an abrupt pucker of air that explodes and quickly evaporates. Could there be a better word for paltry nothing than Bupkis? Imagine my surprise to learn a few years ago that Bupkis in Yiddish actually means sheep or goat poop. That's right, the literal meaning is those little round poop pellets that our smaller ruminants produce. The common use of the term to denote quantities of trivial value is metaphorical. I've been thinking a lot about Bupkis of late in both the literal and figurative senses. In the literal sense, because in the super cold weather we've been letting the sheep sleep in the barn, where they leave an ample nightly supply of Bupkis, some of it, unfortunately, frozen in mounds in their feed bowls, requiring that it be pried loose before we deposit their daily grain treats there. And in the figurative sense, because it has been repeatedly driven home to me of late, that the relative value our society places on food is so low that producing it, at least on a small scale, yields Bupkis for virtually everyone in the chain of production. This week I went to pick up our newly processed pork and lamb, and it's fabulous, folks, try some, from the slaughterhouse and move it to the commercial freezer we rent. Eklund's in Stamford, New York, is a well-kept, clean slaughterhouse, compared to others we've used, and is animal welfare approved, making it worth the hour and a half drive. But I could see that one way it is getting by economically and providing a key service to customers that they can afford is in fact to transfer some labor costs to those customers. Based on my experience with other slaughterhouses, I expected to arrive, pay the bill, back up my truck to a loading dock, load the boxes on, and drive away. Here, however, they wheeled out our nicely wrapped frozen cuts arranged on open plastic trays, handed me a stack of flattened cardboard boxes and some packing tape, and gave me space to make the boxes and pack the meat, a process that took nearly 2 hours. As I worked, the owner mentioned to me that I might be using a little too much of that expensive packing tape to secure the bottoms of the boxes. This surprise additional step in my morning created a dilemma for me, because the commercial freezer we used to store our meats, in order to save its own labor costs, has stopped accepting deliveries after noon. At 11:30, with the freezer still an hour and a half drive away from the slaughterhouse, I had to call and beg the freezer manager to make an exception to their delivery time and allow us to get our pork and lamb into the freezer. After much imploring, he relented, but only if I agreed to pay for the additional hours an employee would be kept on to transport the newly stacked pallets of meat back from the loading dock to the main freezer room. Slaughterhouses in general have notoriously high worker turnover because wages are relatively low and the working conditions tough. It's dangerous and sometimes traumatic work. Working in a commercial freezer, much of the time in a room kept perpetually at 0 degrees Fahrenheit, is for obvious reasons at least as unpleasant, and judging from a perpetually posted help wanted sign outside and a changing cast of characters inside the facility we use must also suffer high turnover. Even wages well above industry standard would be Bupkis compared to the risks and unpleasantness the workers endure. To me, the choices made by both facilities to try to limit labor costs exemplify how deeply those costs must be suppressed to meet the market imperatives of a world of cheap food. As noted in the winter 2018 issue of Sustainable Farming magazine, about 1 in every 7 American workers is engaged in some phase of food production, processing, or distribution. Fully half of them earn less than $10 an hour, which is 2/3 of what is considered a livable wage. Like the rest of the production chain, our farm also faces dilemmas in affording labor, as we've discovered in trying to replace our poor jailed farm helper, Daniel. We are lucky to quickly find an intelligent, skilled, energetic farm helper right off the bat. Someone who, after a few weeks of working with him, we began to hope might ultimately take over the farm operations for his own benefit on our land. But after only a few weeks, he advised us this week that he'd shortly be moving on, out of economic discouragement. He recognized the constraints on our raising his pay beyond the raise we had already given him after his first couple of weeks. He well understood, having done farm work for several years now, that the reduced number of hours of work in the winter was a temporary effect of the weather. It was not the short-term situation that discouraged him. It was, rather, as his 30th birthday approaches, recognizing the reality that food production on this scale offers in the long term only economic insecurity. Apparently, what he has been hearing from his peers, idealists committed to lives in small-scale agriculture, is that there's a glut of strivers out there and few, if any, thrivers. The realization has caused him to rethink his life plans. As I've repeatedly observed, there are two principal ways to make small-scale farming more economically sustainable. One is to raise the retail price of the food so high that all the folks in the chain of production can be paid more than the bupkis they now receive. Unfortunately, that would mean that food raised more slowly and naturally would become more and more confined to the elites who could pay those costs, a process unfortunately already well underway. The alternative would be to shift from using public funds for massive agribusiness subsidies and crop supports that have promoted a cheap national diet based on sugar and corn, with all the adverse health consequences that entails. We could instead create a more even playing field for food raids less efficiently but more healthily, the way the Japanese and the French do, by supporting small farms. There were some small steps in this direction under the Obama administration. How likely is it that we'll take that latter route and give younger folks a reason to think there's a future in small-scale farming? Not very likely, it seems, if you check out what's slated for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the coming year. True, many worthy programs are being funded because existing law requires them to be, but wherever there's an opportunity to cut programs, the 2018 Trump administration budget proposals do so. The slashed support for socially beneficial programs such as environmental research, WIC, a nutrition program aimed at women, infants, and children, and food stamps, which feed poor people, have been somewhat less well publicized. Less well known are the proposals to end several programs begun in past administrations to promote small farms. You can read the budget summary yourself on the USDA website, and there's a useful summary in an article published this week in the Capital Press, a Western Ag website. But what that shows is that the proposed budget would, among other things, eliminate the Specialty Crop Block Grant program, which promotes the competitiveness of fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, dried fruits, horticulture, and nursery crops. It also fails to renew the now expiring Farmers Market Nutrition Program, which allows WIC participants to get fresh fruits and vegetables using their coupons at farmers markets, and the Local Food Promotion Program, which makes grants to promote direct farm-to-consumer marketing. In the big picture of agricultural spending, the sums spent on programs such as these have been barely a blip. Withdrawing even these small efforts to nurture the struggling small farm sector seems almost like an effort to undercut it and prevent it from competing effectively with big agribusiness. In this discouraging environment, it's not surprising that young people cannot see much hope in becoming family farmers. Because, after all, you can't live on bupkis.
Peter Davies and his partner Mark Scherzer are proprietors of Turkana Farm, specializing in heritage breeds of livestock on their 40-acre farm in Germantown, New York. Peter also presides over Turkana Odyssey, in which he customizes cultural tours of Turkey for small groups, which he calls an insider's view of Turkey. And his third hat is Turkana Gallery of Old and Antique Kilims, which he operates in the Wall Street area of Manhattan. Mark presides over his law firm, Mark Scherzer Law Office, which specializes in health law, also in the Wall Street area. Their farm website? TurkanaFarms.com. Their email, farm@TurkanaFarms.com, or 518-537-3815.